casting around, and you after you've been a member for 6 months, you get a magic wand. And I'm kidding.
All right, so Sarah's doing Trust God, Clean House, and Help Others. And it's with great pleasure that I introduce Sarah from Big Book Magic. Tonight she's doing Clean House.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
It's really good to be back here. The crowd's a lot bigger tonight because there isn't a major sports event, I don't think. Yeah, last week was really cool. I, you know, had the expectation that I was going to come here and I was going to kind of do like a clean, like, walkthrough of all the steps. And then after a conversation with my sponsor, I thought it would be better to just kind of focus on what my current experience is, really, you know, with the idea of trusting God, with cleaning house, and then with helping others. So, you know, we talked a lot about God reliance last week, and my experience was that I couldn't have any reliance on God until I had done the cleaning house part to gain access, you know, because I remember the day that I realized that belief in God really didn't matter at all in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not a program about like believing in God or even understanding God or whatever. If a belief in a higher power was sufficient to keep me sober, there would not be priests or clergymen in AA. You know, people who have believed in God their whole life find that they can't control their drinking, they can't not start to drink, and they can't find the power that they need to live life on the level that they want. So it's not about a belief in a power greater than me. I didn't necessarily not believe in God. I didn't really think about God once. The only time I really remember thinking about God was when a drug dealer that I was like hooking up with got arrested right in front of me. And then I was super afraid that that was somehow going to be my fault and that he was going to be really upset with me. And so I was praying like on the street. I think I was drunk. I was praying on the street out loud that God would make sure that nothing too bad happened to him so that he wouldn't be upset with me when he got out of jail. And that was about the extent, you know, of my belief in God. But the, you know, the real work that we're doing here is about, like, clearing away the things that block me from God. You know, it's about, like, getting access. And my experience is that, like, I can't really explain to you what God is or whatever, but God is, like, an experience that I have when I take inventory and share it with somebody. And see like a new level of truth about myself and come to a new level of willingness of like a different way that I might want to live. And when I can see the way that I've harmed people and when I have this awareness that I don't want to do that anymore and when I go to you and I say, I'm sorry that I hurt you and I don't want to do this, what can I do to make it right? All those things. God is like an experience that I have. And I was recently doing inventory with a sponsee and I asked her afterward, I said, how do you feel? And she said, I feel a fulfilling nothingness. And I was like, word, right? Like that's pretty good. And that was my experience right after I did 5, 6, and 7 all at the same time with my sponsor. And I had gone to his house with an overwhelming sense of negativity. You know, Bill Wilson talks about there was a terrible sense of impending calamity, you know, like this idea of like impending doom. And that was like before his writhing nerves were stilled by a couple of drinks. It's like that was his experience sober before the drinks brought him the relief. And I sort of had the expectation that like all of that overwhelming negativity would be replaced by overwhelming positivity, right? Because I'm an alcoholic and I really want to feel very good all the time. And it wasn't that way. It was what happened to me was just all of the overwhelming negativity just simply was removed, and I was okay. Things were very quiet. They were very calm, and I did about a 20-minute period of meditation after that when I had got home before going to a meeting, and I know that they suggest to sit down and review for an hour, you know, if you were thorough. I mean, I knew I was thorough, and the only thing that kept going through my head was, like, I thanked God that I knew God better, because I had a sense of relief and a sense of peace, and I felt this, like, okay, I'm good. I'm being taken care of. What I need to do now is move forward and amend these things, you know, and God really is truly taking care of me. Something that I forgot to discuss last week, in the family afterward, they have this, part that really describes like when I'm getting out of the way, and how this relates to like clean house is that like the clean house is like the build up for like this experience. Okay, right. So we've been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We have been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect, but we aren't a glum lot. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I have a friend that says that, like, sometimes she's like, no, I insist, right? Like, I have to insist on enjoying life because sometimes, like, my brain can maybe not want to do that so naturally. But we try not to indulge in cynicism over the state of the nations, nor do we carry the world's troubles on our shoulders. When we see a man sinking into the mire that is alcoholism, we give him first aid and place what we have at his disposal. For his sake, we do not recount and almost relive the horrors of our past, but those of us who have tried to shoulder the entire burden and trouble of others find we are soon overcome by them. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience out of the past. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered, and we have been given the power to help others. I mean, this is just, like, amazing. Everybody knows that those in bad health and those who seldom play do not laugh much. So let each family play together or separately as much as their circumstances warrant. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. We cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a veil of tears, though it was once just that for many of us. But it is clear that we made our own misery. God didn't do it. Avoid, then, the deliberate manufacture of misery. But if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. So there's a couple things going on here. The idea that, like, my troubles and my misery are of my own making. And my boyfriend's sponsor said this once in a meeting, and I never forgot, the idea that misery actually has to be manufactured. Because if God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free, and God is the only thing that is actually real, joy is the only thing happening. So when I had this experience of cleaning house with my sponsor and feeling some relief from the misery that I was manufacturing, and I stopped manufacturing misery, even though, I mean, the perfection of that experience lasted 24 hours. Since then, it's been daily practice, right, of continuing to take the action, you know, and I get disturbed all the time. But if I didn't have inventory and I didn't have the steps to like continue practicing, like I would be screwed. Like I'm a recovered alcoholic. My obsession to drink alcohol has been lifted. I have the capacity to be useful and helpful to you. I no longer feel like everything is falling down on me. If I'm in a situation that's baffling or troublesome, it's okay. I have the capacity to relax and take it easy. I run it through the process of inventory. I'm willing to learn. I don't have too hard of a grip on the expectations of what exactly should happen, and if I do find myself gripping, it's okay. It's like I'm able to let it go more, but I'm not cured. I'm not cured of alcoholism, and I know that in my bones, right? So I'm very, very happy that I still have this process. But when I stop manufacturing misery for that 24 hours, the most natural thing for me to do was have fun, you know, and It was the thing that made sense. Play, laugh, have fun, relax, enjoy. I mean, it's just like those things were just like kind of like coming out of me. Anyway, those are sort of at the end. Okay, but what's going on with me? I'm an alcoholic. That means not only that I cannot control the amount of alcohol that I drink once I start drinking, but it means that I actually do not have a choice whether I'm going to drink or not. That didn't change when I came into AA. It wasn't like, oh, all of a sudden I came into AA and now I'm around these people and I go to these meetings, so now I have a choice. I can choose not to drink. That wasn't my experience. I came to AA and I was in like a lockdown thing. That was all they did was talk about the 12 steps. It wasn't necessarily like, you know, an AA meeting in the book, but the spirit of AA was in this place, and I ran away from this place after 9 months trying to pursue a drink of alcohol. because I essentially, what happened was I was totally insane. I was suffering from a spiritual malady. I'm full of self, and I had no defense. You know, when the thought to drink came, I was not able to reason. The sanity inside me was not strong enough to reason with the temptation, right? And so I ended up, you know, giving into it regardless of how that would affect me and how that would affect the people who cared about me. And there's a part in We Agnostics that says, the fundamental idea of God is deep down within every man, woman, and child. I believe that God's self, is deep down within every man, woman, and child. And this is sort of my conception. So if it doesn't work for you, it has nothing to do with your conception, and you don't need to believe it. But this is my experience, so I'm just going to share it. And if anything that I say doesn't work for you guys, there's like 35 other people here. Like, talk to somebody else after the meeting. I won't be offended. I can do the inventory that I'm telling you all about, and I can become free of my resentment against you. Or maybe during the critique part, you know, after that I'll walk through it out loud. My sponsor once, somebody dropped a huge profanity in the meeting, and it wasn't just a profanity, it was a very derogatory term that he took very personally. And when he shared, he walked through an inventory out loud on how to become free of the anger that he was feeling against this person and to be an example. I mean, I was like hugely powerful when he shared that with me. But I, you know, I believe that like the spirit of God is like in my heart, right? And like what the steps have done for me is they've moved me from like living in my head to just living in my heart, like clearing away the things that like block me from what's already there. And so, you know, my experience with God, I didn't reference the book a lot last week, so I feel like I should. You know, We Agnostics also says the consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you, but come to me like when? Like I didn't start to have an experience with God working in my life at step three. I had to be at step three in order to like do what I needed to do to like have that experience. But I don't remember if I shared this last week or not, but I would like say the third step prayer. I would try to like will God into my life without doing anything. I would just be like, if I strain all the muscles in my body as I'm saying this prayer and I give it all the effort that I have, maybe God will know I'm serious and God will come and strike me happy. You know, God will change the way that I feel. I'm desperate for relief. And it never worked. I became increasingly more and more and more and more miserable. And I had had like some taste also of like working the steps, but I wasn't, you know, my first four step that I ever did, they threw me in a corner in this treatment program I was at, and they said, you can't get out until you write this thing. And then they had some girl comes in with me who really didn't know what she was doing either. And like, right, and I'm like writing these like stupid columns that I don't understand. I'm getting no freedom. I'm digesting no chunks of truth about myself. I'm not understanding anything. I'm just trying to stay out of trouble. But yeah, eventually, you know, I got into enough pain of just living by my own resources alone and like in my own head that I didn't think that I was going to stay alive. Like I didn't want to stay alive. I didn't know how I was going to survive past the age of 16 if I didn't have some relief from myself, from my sober condition. You know, alcohol was the only thing that worked to fix the way that I felt. And you know, alcohol gave me what the promises talk about. And so I needed like a better way to get the promises. And luckily they are the promises that we get after step nine. So I can just do, you know, not like an isolated step nine where I'm like walking away. I mean, and I don't know, maybe that's what Dr. Bob did. Dr. Bob made all his amends when he had been drinking beer that morning to be still enough to perform a major surgery. And when he left the surgery, he was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this thing that you're telling me about, Bill Wilson. And he went around and made all of his amends that day, and he never drank again. For me, I needed like a lot of preparation and understanding, and like there needed to be some serious shifts that occurred like in the previous steps before I just went out and started making amends to people. But, you know, so this is kind of all build up. this is all build up. What I'm trying to say is my decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God was a great decision, but it required some action, like immediately following. And I believe the wording in the book is like, though our decision was a vital and permanent one, it could have a little permanent effect. Was a vital and important one. It could have little permanent effect unless immediately followed. Was a vital and crucial step. It could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. So this idea that like God is somewhere in here is just, God is just totally blocked off. And what is God blocked off by? Self-centeredness. You know, our troubles we think are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And so the first thing that I do is I start looking at, like, what are the major manifestations of self in my life? Anytime I am disturbed, the problem is with me. It doesn't matter how justified I feel in that, and my sponsor harps on that a lot, you know, but the best thing about that is that I have the capacity and the path to become free of anything that happens, and I have not had to work through super tragic things in my life, but I have had enough example from you, and I'm not going to go cause a tragedy so I could do it and prove to my, you know what I mean, but like I have had enough example from people in my life who have worked through trauma and tragedy and kept the focus on them and became free and got willing to forgive and all that stuff. The first thing that I look at, you know, in this like specific like fourth step, right, is my resentment. And the way that I do resentment inventory a lot. Resentment and fear are probably my most common forms of inventory that I have to process. The sexual conduct inventory is important, and I have also had experience not looking at the sexual conduct inventory not only with like sexual relationships, but with just important, significant relationships. Like when I did my fourth step and I did the conduct inventory, I went through, you know, people I had dated, people who I had had kind of like flirtatious relationships, because there's probably like a lot of grounds for self-seeking. There's probably a lot of like, I have no intentions with you, but I'm using you to make me feel better kind of thing. But also just like people, like significant personal relationships, like people that I spend a lot of time with, like my family. Where am I dishonest? Where am I inconsiderate? You know, where am I selfish with these people? How am I behaving? So it's a great like thing. It's a great inventory just to process as like a conduct, just to check like, how am I being as a friend? How am I being as a daughter? Like if I don't have any like resentment or fear and connection to this person. But resentment's really cool. So the book has taught me to break down resentments into four columns. You know, I'll give like a recent example. And this is like really pertinent to where I am, because like I spent a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, doing like this and that out of the book, and people showing me like this and that out of the book, but I didn't have a relationship, and I didn't have like a basic understanding with the big book. I didn't understand that like this was like the recipe for sobriety, you know. I didn't get it. I sat in meetings a lot, and I thought that this is terrifying, but I thought that everything that people said in meetings was AA and the message of AA. I didn't know that it was like written down somewhere like a little bit more coherently, that I could like relate my experience and then follow it very simply. It's like baking a delicious pie. And so when I got on, there's this hilarious part in the family afterwards. You know, assume on the other hand that Sarah at the outset has had a stirring spiritual experience. Overnight, as it were, she is a different woman. She becomes an AA enthusiast. She is unable to focus on anything else. As soon as her sobriety begins to be taken as a matter of course, the fellowship may look at their strange new friend with apprehension, then with irritation. There's talk about spiritual matters morning, noon, and night. She may demand that the home group find God in a hurry or exhibit amazing indifference to them and say that she is above worldly considerations. She may tell other people who have been members of AA all their life that they don't know what it's all about and that they had better get her brand of spirituality while there is yet time, right? So it's like I have this like burning spiritual experience. All of a sudden the whole thing makes sense. I understand my alcoholism. I understand my need for power. It's amazing. And I'm running around AA telling people that they don't know what they're doing, you know, you know, that's not really helpful to anybody. It's just not. What's helpful is like my practical demonstration of my principles. What's helpful is me like not telling you that you don't know what's going on, but my like cleaning house and finding relief and being able to show up anyway and having people say, how do you do that? You know, if I'm attractive to somebody, like that's helpful. Like me focusing, like the idea that like great events will come to pass for me and countless others if my relationship with God is right. You know, if not, then I'm managing everybody else's relationship with God. And so I've struggled with the big book being something that separates me from people. You know, and it's not only people who don't have the same relationship with the big book that I do. I definitely, it's like, oh, I have like a very basic kind of like judgment separation that I've had to like really inventory like the arrogance in that, you know, and the spiritual pride. But the big book can be something that separates me from other big book people, right? Because I'm so insecure. I relate so much to Bill's story, and I didn't until my sponsor took me through. But I proved to the world that I was important. You know, the inherent low self-esteem in that situation, all of my relationships have been about, you know, this like dependence dynamic, you know, that I'm like seeking something from you. I'm looking. I've never once been free to just freely give love, you know, to just like be a channel and a vessel for God. I have like an expectation and a dependency dynamic in everything that I do. There's hardly ever two people in the room. And I'm not talking about like now, so currently, like, there's been huge shifts and huge progress in that area, but like that has happened before. But it can come up with other people that really know the big book, right? I'll walk into a big book meeting that I've never been to with a base expectation that this is like, you know, regular old group of stumpers. They know the lingo. They know the deal. And immediately I'm like all of the big book stuff that I know, I'm like throwing it out there like a shield, right? Like, no, I know what I'm doing, you know, like don't worry about me. Don't think that I'm new, you know. It's like all this ego, and it's like the big book, like instead of the big book being about love and service and being able to like communicate and transmit this experience where I can like be free enough of self to just like be love and service, it can become this like shield that like separates me from people, you know? And so this all relates to what I started talking about. I swear I'm actually going to start talking about inventory in a second. I bring a meeting into a school on Fridays. It's an alternative high school that has a special focus on substance abuse and mental health. And I asked a girl to be the speaker for me. I hadn't seen her in a long time, and the last I knew, she had joined this kind of like hardcore group in the city, and she had a male sponsor. And so I'm like, all right, like this girl, like she's probably pretty hardcore. And so I go and I meet her, and we have this time, and you know, nobody shows up for the meeting, so we just kind of like check in with each other and like talk and catch up, and then she leaves, and I am like wildly disturbed when I leave her. I feel so uncomfortable. I think I went shopping or something ridiculous, you know, after that. Like, I just felt horrible. And I got home later that night, and I was talking to my mom, and then I was like, you know what, Mom? Like, I need to get a pen and paper right now, and I need to write some inventory, a resentment inventory. And what's cool about that experience, actually, my mom was like, what's that? Resentment inventory? And she was like, well, maybe I have a resentment. How do you write it? I like sat down with my mother at the kitchen table with a big book in between us and like showed her how to write a resentment inventory. You know, it's like our way of life has its advantages for all. By the fourth column, she was like, Sarah, I'm tired. I did not know this was going to be so long. I don't want to do this anymore. And I'm like, no, Mommy, you're almost there. You have to keep going. But so I wrote down, you know, I was like, I need to get to the bottom of this. You know, I need, this is something that is like blocking me, right, from being effective and useful. This is something that is like preventing me from having peace of mind. And this is something that's keeping me, you know, from conscious contact to God right now. So I need to write about it, and I need to see really what it's all about. So I write down who the girl is, and I write down second column. She seemed to be concerned about me. why was I upset with her? She wasn't very communicative, you know. She didn't share of her life, of her personal life, the way that I was sharing. I was like telling her everything that was going on. You know, she was like a little more reserved. I was horrified. I was like embarrassed that I had like, you know, just like thrown up all this stuff, you know, like here I am, here's what's going on, approve of me. And I got nothing, nothing. She was just like, well, call me anytime. Like, like if you ever need help, call me. And I'm like shopping. I'm like, you know, okay, so that's second column, right? But like when we leave the second column, we leave the second column. Like so many times I'm doing inventory with people, we're like, we're on column four, and they start saying something. I'm like, gee, that's funny. That sounds a lot like column two. We're not in column two anymore. We left that town a long time ago. And I go into column three, and the column three is like, what does this affect? You know, it's like, what major part of self is this affecting? And they give us this list, right? Is it my personal relations? Is it my sexual relations? Is it my self-esteem? Is it my ambitions? Is it my pocketbook? Is it my emotional security? So these things. And I recently got put onto like a little bit of a deeper column three that I really enjoy, because the fourth step promise is that I will have digested some major chunks of truth about myself. They're not promising that I have any relief. They're not promising that anything happened. They're promising that I see myself differently, right? I'm the business owner who I'm going through seeing like what has expired, you know, what is no longer working. And I'm kind of separating things. And so I was like, well, it affects my self-esteem, right? So what am I really saying? I'm like, well, she didn't approve of me. You know, she didn't treat me the way that I wanted to be treated. She didn't comfort me and tell me that everything was going to be okay, and that affects my self-esteem. So what's another way of saying that? Oh, my self-esteem is attached to being approved of by other people. Simply, it doesn't have anything to do with her. It's like me. It affects my personal relationships. Well, what about it affected my personal relationship? I feel like I don't want to be close to her now. You know, I feel like I don't want to be close to people unless, you know, we have this like connection, or unless she's seeing me. It's like the exact same thing. It's like my personal relationships are attached to people seeing me in a certain way. So I'm consistently trying to like prove to you, I'm showing up, here I am. I'm Big Book Sarah. I'm Spiritual Sarah, as Dave named me for this series of talks, you know. But essentially, it's like my self-esteem and my personal relations are not derived from like a secure sense of God's presence and like a desire to be helpful to people, right? It's like, it's not about that. My emotional security, you know, I feel insecure when other people are not expressing love and validation, right? So I'm like so self-centered. And I think that was like it, you know. And sometimes I do an individual column three for every resentment in column two. Sometimes I don't feel that that's necessary. But if it's like a really big resentment and I really feel like I need to break it down that much, I will. Other times I feel like I can sort of, you know, do one column three and check to make sure that I've covered every point in column two. And then I move on to column four. But before I move on to column four, they give us this thing called the sick man prayer. And they say, now, you know, we're going to review our list thoroughly now that we're done. And we're going to be prepared to look at these people from a whole different standpoint. And the standpoint is that these people are spiritually sick, just like me. You know, and then I'm going to ask God to relieve me from being angry, to show me how I can be helpful, and to help me to treat them the way that I would treat any other sick person. I have a hard time with this prayer because I don't always believe that the person that I'm resentful at is spiritually sick. Not that I just think they're a horrible person, but I usually feel like I'm the spiritually sick one. Like, I, like, victim. Like, when I have resentment against my boyfriend, I'm like, he's not spiritually sick. He's just, like, beautiful, loving person. And I'm a nut job who doesn't know how to be intimate or who doesn't know how to be in a relationship, you know what I mean? So I sometimes don't feel the need to, like, pray for this person is spiritually sick. No, they're not. You know, I am. And so I don't always say that prayer. It depends on, like, really depends on, like, how angry I am and how justified I feel I am. I feel like that's the gauge for me. But then the direction, you know, that you guys gave me is to put out of my mind the wrong that the other person has done and to focus on four things. Where had I been selfish? Where had I been self-seeking? Where had I been dishonest? And what are my fears? And so selfish, boom. I showed up. The entire thing from the get-go was about me and how she was going to make me feel. That's it. You know, I did not show up with a spirit of, oh, I haven't seen this girl in such a long time. I wonder what she's up to. We're going to bring this meeting in. We're going to give these kids some hope. It's going to be amazing. No, I was tired. I was in fear for something the night before. I was totally in self. The whole thing was about me from the start. I'm thinking about me the whole time. I'm in total fear about what she's thinking about me. Okay, write that down. That's where I'm selfish, self-seeking. I'm trying to derive self-esteem and security from, like, how she's treating me and how she's making me feel. You know what I mean? I'm, like, I'm trying to give her everything that I think she's going to want to hear for her to say, wow, Sarah, you are really on the beam. I'm tatering on the beam. You know what I mean? Like, I'm about to fall off. So that's self-seeking, right? It's like every time I'm trying to, like, gain my sense of security from, like, how you see me, I'm trying to, like, get my sense of self, like, through your eyes. And this is like the truth, right? About, like, where I'm at with this girl or where I can be many of the times. Like, just thank God people in AA in 1935 knew what I was going to need in 2012 to be able to show up for life like a normal person, you know? Just, like, incredible. Dishonest. I don't remember exactly what. Oh, the biggest dishonesty on that day, I was trying to show her that I had everything all together, and I didn't. I didn't have it all together. There was some fear that was going on. There was a lot of self-centeredness. There was some, like, whatever, anxiety. I didn't have it all together. And when she said, "How are you?" instead of saying, "You know, in general, I'm okay, but today I really don't have it together. I'm glad we're at this meeting." I was like a juggling buffoon trying to make sure that I seemed like I had it all together so that she could be impressed by my Alcoholics Anonymous program. I get here because I'm, like, a hopeless alcoholic, and I'm trying to be the best, like, the most recovered one here. This isn't, like, I mean, I'm not trying to put us down. We're brilliant, creative, awesome people, but this isn't, like, you know, the President's List Club. You know, this is like last house on the block for, like, for alcoholics. But we have each other. It's nice. And fear, you know, I'm essentially, it's like most of my fears come down to, like, I'm afraid that I won't be loved. I'm afraid God's not going to take care of me. I'm afraid, you know, I'm afraid to, like, never feel safe. And you know, I had a lot of those fears that I'm not good enough and blah, 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 blah. I fear that she judged me. So what if she judged me? The idea is, like, we write down our fear and we ask, like, why we ask ourselves why we have this fear. I'm afraid she's going to judge me. Well, why am I afraid of that? Because if she judges me, I feel horrible about myself. What if I feel horrible about myself? Well, then I have no sense of relief, you know, and I'm either going to, like, kiss butt and then feel even more miserable, or it's just never going to go away or whatever, and most of my fears spiral out to, like, I'm going to end up drinking and dying. You know, it's just, like, going to be the worst thing ever in my, like, fearful world. And so I, like, totally saw the truth, right? So I went from feeling like, oh, what's up with her, right? To being like, oh, this problem was entirely of my own making. It was completely rooted in self. And but what do I do about that, right? Like, here's where the rest of the steps come in, because I love this part in step three from How It Works. I relate to it so much. Where it says we could wish to be, above everything, the alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. There often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. The only way that I know how to get God's help through prayer and the process of 4 through 9. That's the only way that I know how to, like, clear enough of, like, Sarah away to get, like, Sarah's spirit sort of, like, coming to the surface and, like, expressing itself naturally. That's just the experience that I've had in AA, and that's what you guys taught me. So once I saw the truth about myself, I'm like, God, there's nothing that I can do to make myself different. I can't like, go in and, like, cut out this, like, part of me that, like, is desperate for approval and validation. But I can recognize it for what it is, and I can really ask for help, you know? And I can, like, you know, what would the opposite of that look like? Oh, it would look like me knowing that I'm enough, having, like, some security in my relationship with God, and asking for a constant thought of others and how I can help meet their needs. It would look like me showing up for this girl with a genuine sense of, oh, hey, I haven't seen you in a long time. How have you been? What's going on in your life? You know, and then listening. And just being there and not expecting anything, affirming that, like, things are complete and that it is all okay. So, like, am I willing to maybe have that experience? Am I willing to grow towards that? Am I willing to ask God to relieve me of the self-centeredness and trust enough that, like, my solution is not working and there might be a better one and that I can, like, become available for that experience? Yes, I'm willing. God, help. So it's kind of like 6 and 7. Sometimes at this stage in the game, I take inventory so often that, like, sometimes it just hits me very naturally, and I don't need to kind of run it through and process with somebody. My first major 4-step, I absolutely needed to do that, and probably 95% of the time I do that. But this one, it was like the steps kind of, like, just kind of came out of me very naturally. Like, I knew instantly. Like, I was still at the kitchen table when this was happening, and something very humbling thought came to me, and it said, "You need to call her and tell her the truth." And I was like, "Oh boy, okay." It was just a beautiful experience. And as soon as I knew that I needed to make an amends to her and that I needed to, like, confess, like, all of the self-centeredness and all of the self-seeking, this giant sense of relief came over me. It was done. It was already over. All I needed to do was make the call. I called her the next morning. I had told my sponsor or somebody, I don't remember. I was like, I have this amends to make. But it felt natural. I trusted the instinct. It was fine. She didn't call me for, like, 2 weeks. I called her once, left a message, called her again, left a message, and then dropped it. And, like, 3 weeks later, she finally called me. And when we connected, I just said, I owe you an apology. I spent the entire time that we were together a couple weeks ago trying to impress you because I thought that would make me feel better about myself. I had an image of you as being this woman in this hardcore group with a male sponsor, and I thought that I needed you to know that I played hardball with the boys, you know, and because of that, I was not present for you at all, and I was not a friend. I was hardly even there, and you deserved so much more than that from me, and is there anything I can do to make it right? And, you know, she's, like, a loving, amazing woman in AA, and she felt like it was totally unnecessary, but she thanked me, and then she supported me. I was on my way to a job interview, and, like, that's essentially, like, at this stage in the game, like, the way that the process works for me, like, the way that I, like, feel this giant disturbance, and then I need most of the time to write it out. I feel the relief when I write it out, and I take it through the steps. Yeah, and then it was just, like, disturbance over, you know, and then I, like, went through the rest of my day, you know. I only have a couple minutes left. I talked a little bit about the fear inventory. I write down what the fear is because at some point during that, like, huge paragraph of spiraling out what I'm afraid of, I can see what I'm really depending on instead of God. I'm depending on, like, validation, or I'm depending... It usually comes to, like, I'm relying on a human power, you know, to, like, for security. And again, like, this is, like, that's, like, essentially, like, self-knowledge, you know, just like seeing it, like self-knowledge. And like, that's great. It's like where I have to start, but I can't necessarily just change it and make myself not be afraid anymore. And then what I do is, it says, we ask God, do I have to stop talking?
I am not rushing you.
Okay. I'm afraid of what Dave thinks about me.
As you should be.
You can critique me during the critique session afterwards. Essentially, once I have the fear and I see what it is, I was taught to say, like, you know, the formula is like, we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention towards what God would have us be. And so something that's been super awesome and helpful for me is, if I didn't have this fear, what would my life look like? You know, God, what would you have me be instead of fearful? And I was like in a lot of fear at my brother's birthday about a situation, and I was like suffering about it, and I paused, took a deep breath, got out my computer, wrote a fear inventory, said, you know, God, what would you have me be instead of fearful? And I closed my eyes and I started writing everything that came to me. And I just had like the most powerful experience with that format, because the things that were coming to me had nothing to do with fear. They were like, if I wasn't afraid right now, I would join the party. I would ask his friend how he was doing. I would sit down and eat dinner. I would get a glass of water. I would call a sponsee. I would have fun. And like all these things. And like as this like intuition, this like intuitive self pouring out of me, I'm becoming farther and farther and farther away from this fear that was dominating and running my life 5 seconds ago. You know, and I instantly feel back in line, right? Like back in touch with like the God inside of me. Like I'm sure that God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. Like it is not that bad. And then I have like my plan of action. I'm like, okay, so now I have to go do those things. You know what I mean? And like meet God halfway in that sense. So that's like the setup for the amends process, like 4, 5, 6, 7. That's kind of like how I work 10 though more now. It's like in the moment, like as I feel disturbed, but like I did a more formal, like long version of like that inventory and the fear. And then I did look at like, you know, my conduct and like the way that I was like self-centered essentially and like using people. Like it's like this whole thing, like all of my discernments boils down to my self-centeredness and my like inherent inability to just like love people and like be there for you guys and be unselfish. But I've had some like really amazing experiences with amends, like on the bigger scale, because amends are very, very important. My first 8-step that I did in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started making the amends and then I just stopped. And I had no correlation between not making amends and the misery that I was feeling. When I started going through the steps again last year, and one thing that I did was I made sure to be very, very thorough about my 8th and 9th step. I took my first one back out. I uncovered it from wherever it was. I went through through the 4th step that I had just did, and I checked off all the names that I felt like the resentment had actually caused harm to the people. I could see the harm that I caused in my 4th column. Not everybody on my 4th step knew, and not everybody in my 4th step needed to know. Like those things would just cause more harm if I went and said, you know, I really hate you, you're really terrible. But there were a lot there that I needed to do the same thing that I had done with that girl and really clear up my side of the street, so that I could just be like more helpful, more useful. You know, I started going through that, and that was like maybe 6 or 7 months ago. I had like 60 people on my amends. I mean, I was like everyone that I have ever known that I have even possibly, you know, mistreated was like on that. Like, I wanted the demon like out. You know, I was like, I was done. I have like 13 names left. Most of them I have already made one approach to, and it's not quite time. I potentially have an amends scheduled for like a little bit later. Like it's possible. It's possible to make your amends. You know, it's not impossible. It's possible, and it feels really good. There's something magical that happens. You know, when I'm in the steps, when I'm not just trying to manage my life with my own thoughts about what that should be like, but when I'm just like showing up for the step process. You know, And so basically, like, as soon as I started making amends in terms of, like, cleaning house, I started doing morning and night step 11 as it's outlined in the book. And I also started doing a weekly inventory with my sponsor. So step 10 is essentially designed to be practiced for me every time I feel disturbed in the moment. I'm watching for selfishness, dishonesty, and resentment and fear. I'm, like, turning away from these things constantly all day. I don't do that perfectly, you know. And what's helpful for me is that earlier this morning, every week, my sponsor and I have an appointment, and the day before, or if it's that night, that morning, I send him a written, it's kind of like a written four-step. It's like a long 10-step. I confess any mistakes that I've made that week. I write about all areas of selfishness. I inventory any resentment that I have. I write about all dishonesties, and I inventory any fears that I have. And then I have eighth and ninth step up for consideration. So I have, like, a running eighth and ninth step list going on, and I will read this with my sponsor every week. And that, coupled with, you know, like, activity in my ninth step, it hasn't resulted in me, like, floating around the world and feeling amazing all the time, but it's given me the sense of, like, emotional stability, like I said before, that even when things are not figured out and I don't have it all, that it's, like, it's okay. Like, it's okay. Like, I'm showing up. I'm, like, fairly present, you know. I'm, like, fairly able to, like, help people, and I'm, you know, living my life, I think, the way God would have me live, not the way that, you know, I necessarily myself, my lower self, would have me live all the time. So I do a lot of inventory, and I also kind of believe that, like, God is much bigger than the format, like, not worshiping the format, being open to, like, different ways of doing inventory and, like, lots of other outside spiritual teaching. But where I'm at right now in my sobriety, I found that, like, just not resisting the format and, like, actually putting pen to paper and, like, trying to stay diligent about that, it is helpful for me to, like, get connection to God. And maybe when I grow a little bit more, I will not need to write inventory down so much, but for right now, like, it's working, so I don't really question it. And it's 7:30 p.m. Thanks for letting me share.
Okay, so this is where we open it up for comments, critiques, questions, concerns.